to pass a federal right to try law, House Republicans have failed to muster the votes to pass a key compromise measure earlier this week. The legislation was rejected by a vote of 259 to 140. The bill needed two-thirds majority to pass under an unusual suspension of rules. The vote was an embarrassing defeat, not only for House Republicans, but for President Trump, who called on Congress to quickly pass right-to-try legislation, and Vice President Pence, a longtime supporter of the effort. It was also a rare misstep for Speaker Paul Ryan, who, like most congressional leaders, almost never schedules votes on legislation without some certainty that the given measure has the right to pass, has the support to pass, excuse me. The controversial right to try bill would offer a pathway for patients with terminal diseases to get around Food and Drug Administration rules to request an experimental treatment from a drug maker before the agency has approved the drug. Supporters of the legislation, including the Libertarian Goldwater Institute that first conceived of the idea, say it would offer a necessary respite from what they say are overly cumbersome FDA rules. Critics of the bill point out that the FDA already has a program in place to offer access to medicines to terminal patients, and the agency grants some 99% of all the requests it receives, often within a short time frame. They also argue that without more FDA oversight of the use of experimental therapies, desperate patients could be vulnerable to bad actors or unsafe treatments. It's unclear what the next steps for the bill may be. The House could take up the measure anew or a similar one under normal House rules, which are slower but only require a simple majority. It's also possible that Republican leadership could negotiate with their Democratic counterparts to include some or all of the bill's provisions into an omnibus spending measure expected to come before Congress later this month. And finally, the congressional newspaper The Hill reports that President Trump's cancer panel says urgent action is needed on rising drug costs. Cancer drugs can enter the market with a price tag of more than $100,000 a year, meaning thousands of dollars in out-of-pocket costs for cancer patients. The White House panel noted that the prices of many cancer drugs don't reflect their value or health benefit. The panel urged President Trump to support policies that propose sustained, predictable funding for government agencies that work to provide affordable access to innovative cancer drugs. The panel also recommended that the administration promote pricing of cancer drugs based on the potential value to the patient, stimulate competition in the generic drug markets, ensure the FDA has appropriate resources to assess cancer drug safety and efficacy, and invest in research to develop innovative, high-value cancer drugs. However, the White House advisory group did not offer specific steps or actions for the administration to take. The Trump administration unveiled modest proposals to bring down drug costs, including ones that would put a cap on out-of-pocket costs spending for enrollees in Medicare's prescription drug programs, and cut Medicare payments to remove an incentive for doctors to prescribe higher-priced drugs. As a presidential candidate, Trump said he would allow the government to negotiate drug prices for Medicare beneficiaries, but so far, no action has been taken on that front by the administration. The new Health and Human Services Secretary, Alex Azar, who also served in the department under former President George W. Bush, has indicated that he doesn't support those measures. And that's the Health Action News for this week. We'll be back with our first segment in a moment, taking a look at the issue of gun violence as a public health issue. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Health Action. I'm Mark Hanna. In our first interview segment today, we're going to be taking a look at how doctors are responding to all the new attention around gun violence, particularly that's happening involving teenagers, public schools, and children. Our guests are Dr. Nina Agarwal, who's the National Gun Violence Campaign Coordinator for Doctors for America. And our second guest is Dr. Jeff Oestreicher, who's an emergency room physician here in New York City in Queens. Welcome, Nina and Jeff. Let me just start. First of all, let's ground this in reality. Let's share a story. Like, Nina, what's an experience that sort of animates you around this issue?
Hi, thanks for having us here today, Mark. Yes, I'm a pediatrician, and I work in the Bronx, and I see kids every day have been exposed to violence. So, you know, the issue of keeping kids safe, it goes beyond injuries. It goes to children who hear gunshots in their neighborhoods, who don't feel safe getting home from school, who have family members getting shot and dying. So it's an issue that goes beyond the 9 children a day that are dying, which is tragic in itself, but it probably goes to millions of children that are affected by gun violence.
And Jeff, in your experience as an emergency room doctor?
I would say, thank you for having me, first of all. I work at a large level one trauma center for kids, and so we actually see a lot of having been shot. And in trying to do some research to figure out how to take better care of these kids, how to increase their survival and decrease morbidity and mortality, we faced some serious roadblocks, some political roadblocks in trying to do this research and just trying to examine the medical data. And so that sort of has gotten me involved in this issue on federal research and pediatric firearm injury.
So, Nina, traditionally the debate in this country around gun violence has been sort of framed as a gun rights versus gun control or gun restrictions thing. But there's also another frame that talks about it as a health issue. Can you sort of lay out that frame for us?
Right. Gun violence is a issue. Right now, it's the third leading cause of death in children, and it's preventable. It's an injury that's preventable. And this is not, unfortunately, the issue has become politicized, and where it is a health issue, and kids are dying. We need to figure out why they're dying. We need data. We need research. We need policies in place to keep children safe. And this is what we do as doctors. We provide injury prevention education to keep children safer. And we need to do that for gun violence.
And Jeff, you've been, I was at a meeting with you and Nina the other evening where you talked about how you kind of got into all the research aspects of this. Can you sort of share that story with us?
Yes. So there are a bunch of physicians around the country, trauma physicians and emergency room doctors, who do research every day on how to decrease, how to increase survival and decrease morbidity from different pediatric injuries, and we're allowed to do that research and examine that data for every other injury, except for pediatric firearm injury. And what I mean by that is that there is a federal amendment. It's been in the news a lot lately. It's called the Dickey Amendment, which essentially prohibited the CDC from engaging in research that, quote, promoted gun control or gun control advocacy. And that was interpreted very broadly over the next 20 years. That was in the 90s. And essentially, very intentionally, it was created by sort of the NRA point person in Congress at the time. His name was Jay Dickey. That's why it's called the Dickey Amendment, to basically discourage people who were collecting data that looked badly upon gun ownership. And that it's not, a lot of people say it's a ban. It's not literally a ban. It really just says that we're not allowed to advocate on behalf of gun control. But what it's been interpreted so broadly that now we're no longer even allowed to examine any data that has anything to do with firearm injury prevention. And so that's why we're out here talking about how we need to just repeal this Dickey Amendment, because it has gotten to the point where any examination of raw data having anything to do with firearm injury or prevention is essentially no longer allowed.
But there is some literature on it, correct? And what does this show?
So it's interesting. You know, the RAND Corporation, which is a nonpartisan research institute, recently just released probably the most comprehensive piece of literature on the available evidence we have on gun legislation and its effect. And what it found is that we do have very good data that some policies work. For example, a lot of the child prevention, child access laws that, say that guns need to be locked in the home and stored away from ammunition. Rand found that those do lead to decreased firearm injury and accidental shootings in kids. But for a large amount of proposed gun legislation, what it found is that there's insufficient evidence to conclude whether or not things actually work. The most interesting part of that study is that it also surveyed 95 gun policy experts across the ideological divide that sort of self-identified as their views aligning with the NRA versus those views aligning with the Brady campaign, which is a gun control organization. And what it found is that there's more agreement than disagreement. There is a majority of people in this country and gun legislation experts who agree that we should have policies that decrease more firearm suicide and firearm homicide. The problem is there is a disagreement on what policies actually achieve that, and that's why we need data-driven answers to answer those questions.
Nina, the NRA, in response to school shootings and mass shootings in recent years, has said that this is not really a gun control problem, it's a mental health problem. And there's sort of this idea out there that, we need mental health solutions. And I think that people who look at this public health frame sort of think that that's a bit of a red herring, if you will. Can you talk about this idea of the so-called myth of mental illness in regard to gun violence prevention?
Right. That gun violence is caused by mental illness primarily is a myth. And the data, as Jeff was saying, tells us that mental illness is actually the cause of a small, people who are mentally ill actually are more likely to be victims of gun violence than be perpetrators of gun violence. So that's become a scapegoat issue, and it's taking the focus off of what really causes people to perpetrate gun violence. And what's substantiating that is data that says people have a history of domestic violence, people have a history of substance abuse, people have a history of violent crime. Those are some of the risk factors that cause somebody to perpetrate gun violence. So we need to support more mental health resources always. We need to keep our eye on the ball and what does the data say, and the target is not necessarily mental illness.
So the doctors that you're working with, Jeff, as you're kind of looking forward to what research needs to be done, what research does need to be done?
So this is a long answer, and we could have a whole show dedicated to what questions we need answered. But essentially, I break it up into the questions that medical professionals are interested in. So, for example, what things in an emergency room or in an ambulance in the pre-hospital setting lead to more kids surviving from gunshots? But then all of the answers to the questions on gun policies. And right now we find that, and you hear it in the news and you hear it in debates in your neighborhoods, that a lot of the arguments being made right now are ideologically driven and anecdotally driven, and very few are evidence-based and data-driven. So, for example, people talk about an assault weapons ban, but, Rand said we don't know best how to implement an assault weapons ban and the effect of an assault weapons ban. Handgun legislation. Name a piece of policy legislation, there's insufficient evidence to conclude how best to implement it. And so, this is sort of where we're starting, and there are so many questions like these that need to be answered.
Well, you're listening to Health Action. We're interviewing a couple of doctors here about how all the new attention about gun violence and sort of how the medical and public health profession is responding. Our guests are Dr. Nina Agarwal, who's the National Gun Violence Campaign Coordinator for Doctors for America, and Dr. Jeff Oestreicher, who's an emergency room physician here in New York City in Queens. Nina, let's shift the conversation now. There's all this activism that's emerged in the last few weeks, led by high school students or catalyzed by high school students. Talk a little bit about how the medical profession is responding to that activism, that new activism.
Yeah, as medical professionals, we're so happy to see kids out there talking about how we can keep kids safe. You know, it again, it's not a political issue. It's about kids dying from it. And kids are saying, look, this is doing nothing is unacceptable. We need to do something. And we can't let the NRA tell us that we can't keep kids safe. So, you know, we support the students for Doctors America from doctors who are with Doctors for America are supporting kids today. And we've actually written school notes for kids to get out of school for that 17-minute walk out today. So more power to the kids.
And Jeff, in your work as an emergency room physician for children and young adults, youth, teenagers, as you treat someone who comes in with a gunshot injury of some sort, beyond the sort of immediate medical treatment, what are sort of the things that then need to happen with those patients to kind of get them through the experience and back to normal, if one could say that?
You know, we're seeing these kids and their families in the singular crisis of their lives. And so I will be very candid and say that where I'm seeing them in the trauma bay, we are really focusing on saving their life. As far as all of the other downstream effects of firearm injury and firearm violence and trauma, there are much better physicians than I, and social workers and nurses, trauma counselors, therapists who are dealing with the downstream effects of the actual trauma. And Nina can talk better than I about those effects. But in the trauma bay, when everyone's adrenaline is, at 100, we are really just focused on stopping bleeding and stopping and really preventing death.
And within your organization, the Academy of Pediatric Medicine, what's the conversation like around these issues?
Well, right now, it's how absolutely floored we are by the kids who are essentially at the forefront of all this right now. For so long, really, it felt like nothing was happening. And all of a sudden, the winds definitely feel like they are shifting. On my way here, I was looking at the paper, and an op-ed in the New York Times this morning is written by three New Jersey high school students about the march today, the march for our lives on the 24th. And I was thinking, first I was thinking, do you know how many op-eds of mine the New York Times has rejected? and these kids,
you need to be 18.
More than I care to share publicly. But the point is, these kids are fired up. This is not a quixotic, you know, this is not a fleeting issue for them. This is the defining issue of their lives. And also, I should add that a majority of these students will be voting age in the fall of 2020. And so I sense a real change, and it is 100% because of these kids.
Nina, Jeff mentioned the March for Our Lives that's coming up. The big central march will be in Washington, D.C., but there are satellite marches all over the place, solidarity marches, I guess, including one here in New York City. And this meeting that we were at the other night was talking about pulling together a contingent of health professionals for that. Can you talk a little bit about what the plans are so far?
Right. Well, the plans are to mobilize physicians, medical students across the country, cities, whether it be rural, urban, suburban. And, you know, what we've coined it as March for Our Patients' Lives. So we stand in solidarity with everybody who's been a victim of gun violence and our mission, which is to keep people healthy and safe. So we've linked up with many physician groups, and we hope to see a sea of white coats on the day of March 24th, March for Our Lives.
And here in New York City, my understanding is that groups will be forming up along Central Park West starting in the morning, and then they will be marching down Central Park West and somewhere to Midtown. I know the details are still in flux, I think. Do you have anything more to add?
We welcome everybody to join us, join Doctors for America. You can go to our website, find out how you can join in a march, and we're happy to help out, support you.
And Jeff, are the pediatricians mobilizing for this?
Yes. We, like Nina said, there are doctor's notes that Doctors for America has created that are essentially giving students a doctor's note to get out of school to support their fellow students and the students who lost their lives. And just in all across the country, not just pediatricians, but ER doctors and trauma physicians, surgeons, nurses are all mobilized on this issue, and research is at the forefront of all of this. And it was not well known, you know, 3 months ago that we were having a hard time doing the research. And now I think in the common language right now are things like the Dickey Amendment, an effective research ban. And so people are angry and mobilized for sure.
And Nina, you were up in Albany last week talking to state legislators about this. What moves are afoot in state government here?
Well, coincidentally, I was up in Albany last Tuesday lobbying to restore gun violence research. As we talked about, there's been an effective ban, and that's been created on the CDC, and that's created a chilling effect throughout the whole research community. So whatever the policy is that we propose, we need data to say it works and to sustain it. So when I was up in Albany on Tuesday, I spoke with people that were Democrats, people that were Republicans, and everybody agrees we need research. And, you know, the interesting thing is a lot of people don't know about this ban. And I think, you know, what I came across that day is the more we raise awareness of this issue, the more people we can come to the middle and say, look, we need to get research. The other thing that we talked about was safe storage. I did a research project on what's called the Ask Campaign, which is Asking Saves Kids. And that's promoted by the American Academy of Pediatrics. And it's educating parents if there's on asking if there's a gun where their child plays. And I did a research project on this in the Bronx, and we found that 96% of parents want gun safety education. And this is not gun control. This is not gun reform. This is gun safety education. So if you are going to have a gun in your house, keep it locked, keep it unloaded with the ammunition in a separate place. Nobody wants a kid to die from a gun injury. So we need to think about ways to keep kids safer. So what I came across that day is like we are making progress on this. You know, safe storage is now up in Albany being the debate is happening whether we can fully support it. There's talk of creating a firearm research center in New York, and you know, there's a lot that we can do right here in the States, and then at the same time work on it federally.
Well, we've been talking in this interview segment for the program today about how doctors are responding to all the new attention around gun violence and reframing how the debate is trying to be reframed as a public health issue away from the issue of just simply gun rights versus gun control. Our guests have been Dr. Nina Agarwal, who's the National Gun Violence Campaign Coordinator for Doctors for America, and Dr. Jeff Oestreicher, who's a pediatric emergency room doctor at a New York City hospital here in Queens. Thank you both, Jeff and Nina, for joining us on Health Action today. We'll be back with our second interview segment, taking a look at what's going on in Congress these days around healthcare. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Health Action. I'm Mark Hannay. In this interview segment, we're going to be catching up on what's going on down in Washington around healthcare and related issues. Joining us is Ethan Rome, who's co-executive director of Healthcare for America Now. Welcome back to Health Action, Ethan.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
So there are a few basic things going on. The first thing is probably sucking up a lot of the oxygen in the room, as the phrase goes, is what's called an omnibus spending bill that Congress is crafting. But before we get to the particulars of that, we haven't talked about this probably in a few weeks on this program, so let's do a little catch up. Something happened in early to mid-February that set up this whole process now around the bill. So let's kind of start there. What happened in Congress at that point?
And they passed a continuing resolution to keep the government operating. And in so doing, they funded a number of things, but they left a number of things unfunded. And what it's essentially done is create an opportunity where this is seen as the last chance to pass any legislation in this Congress before the 2018 cycle. And so that's why the market stabilization bill that's so important to the ACA, to the Affordable Care Act, is part of that process.
Right. So at that time, they came up with a general overall plan, and now they're sort of working out a bill that fleshes out all the particulars. So the first thing they did was something around the Children's Health Insurance Program, which had been kind of hanging out there for a while, and nothing had happened. So what did they decide around that?
They extended the Children's Health Insurance Program by 10 years, first by 6 in the first continuing resolution that was in early February, and then in the second continuing resolution, they extended it by another 4 years. They also reauthorized funding for the community health centers, which they had failed to do. And so in both cases, for reasons that were completely gratuitous, the Republicans were holding that up as part of the negotiations over other issues, but those things got funded in the continuing resolutions.
And they also did some things around Medicare, particularly the prescription drug program. What happened there?
They made some minor adjustments to the prescription drug program, but I'm not an expert on that. I'm not sure. What are you referring to, Mark?
I think they're just going to close the infamous donut hole a year earlier than normal, than they had planned. And I think that's kind of where that's at. And that might be good news for people on Medicare, certainly. All right. So they're working on this new omnibus bill now, which, as you say, will be the final major piece that everyone's expecting them to take up before they all go home and run for reelection. Where are we at in that process, and when are we expected to see things? How is the timing looking?
It's anybody's guess what the timing is really looking like. The deadline is the 23rd of March, and so that's when there needs to be action. And what's happening between now and then is that Senators Alexander and Murray are negotiating over the so-called market stabilization bill, which has to do with infusing money into the ACA markets to stabilize them and reduce future rate increases and help deal with the consequences of the Congress, of the GOP, repealing the individual mandate.
That was part of the tax bill at the end of last year.
That's correct. I mean, essentially what we're not talking about, I mean, is you know, there's a fundamental war on healthcare that's being waged by the GOP, and it took the form of the tax bill. It's taking the form of a tax on Medicare and Medicaid. It's taking the form of the tax on women's health, on the uninsured. We now have a budget from the president that slashes programs for working families, and that's the context within which this continuing resolution, this budget package for March 23rd is taking place.
Let's maybe take those things kind of one by one. How the Trump administration has for quite a while now been doing whatever it can without necessarily going to Congress to undermine the Affordable Care Act. What are some things that they've been up to lately?
They've proposed a rule to allow what are called short-term health plans. These are plans that right now are limited to 3 months, and they want to extend them to 364 days. And what's important about these plans is that these plans allow discrimination based on health, discrimination based on sex. They eliminate lifetime and annual limits. So all of the protections under the ACA, they eliminate essential health benefits. All of the protections under the ACA, almost all of them, go away under these short-term plans. And so it's a sneaky way to get around the ACA, and it's a way of rolling back rolling us back in time, putting the insurance companies back in charge of our health care. And so that's one of the big things that they want to do. Related to that, they want to expand association health plans. These are health plans that are created by associations of different kinds, and it sounds like a great thing, but it's the same problem. Association health plans don't have to meet the same requirements as ACA compliant plans, and so what you end up having are more plans in the marketplace that don't meet the ACA, and then what's the problem with that? The problem is that younger, healthy individuals might choose these short-term plans that only cover them in catastrophic situations instead of participating in the ACA marketplaces, and that weakens the marketplaces, raises premiums for everyone else, and makes it harder for the uninsured to get coverage.
The other thing that the administration is up to is it's coming up with all kinds of new rules around people getting and using Medicaid. What are they doing on that front?
This is an absolute crime. There's an assault on Medicaid that's taking place in two ways. The first is on the budget side, right? And then we'll talk about the rules. On the budget side, they're trying to slash Medicaid by $1.4 trillion, which would decimate the program and cause millions of people to go without insurance. On the rules side, they're approving requests by states, which they've encouraged states to make, that require institute work requirements for Medicaid recipients. And there's a million reasons why these make no sense. But people aren't working frequently because they have a disability, because they're caring for a family member, because they're in between jobs and looking for work. And all these work requirements do is require paperwork for people to fill out, and they require, and it requires a whole new bureaucracy. In Kentucky, which is one of the states that's gotten one of these waivers, they've now decided that it's going to cost them several million dollars to implement that program just so that they can have the personnel to track the paperwork. In Idaho, they were considering a bill on Medicaid work requirements, and it may be moving forward, but they were considering a bill. And what their own state agency figured out is at the end of the day, when you allow for all the exceptions to it, like people with disabilities, for example, it was only going to affect 700 people. And so it's a punitive measure designed to make it difficult for people to get insurance. And the simple reason that they're doing this is to reduce the number of people on Medicaid. That's the goal. The goal is to save money by eliminating people from Medicaid who ought to be able to get coverage. And so far the administration has approved waivers, so-called waivers, in Kentucky, in Indiana, and Arkansas. And there's seven or eight places that have pending applications, New Hampshire, Arizona, Utah, Wisconsin, Kansas, Mississippi, and Maine.
And the good news is we don't have anything like that immediately here in the New York area, in either New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, or Connecticut. But depending on who gets elected governor and legislators and so forth in those states, that can all change pretty quickly. The 8th anniversary of the Affordable Care Act is coming up later this month. What are groups that are involved with HCAN planning and doing around that?
Groups all across the country are going to be having birthday celebration events. They're also going to be having accountability events on Republican members of Congress who have obviously been trying to take away the ACA. And so all across the country, we're going to be hitting the streets and making noise in celebration of the law, in defense of the law, and holding accountable to people who want to take it away.
What is the public opinion research showing these days on the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid programs that the federal government runs? You mentioned family planning, that have been so under attack for the last year or so.
They're incredibly popular. Medicaid continues to be very popular. It's in the high 60 and 70%. People support it. on the ACA. The ACA is at its most popular ever, and in the 10 states where senators are Democratic senators are up for re-election where Trump won, the vast majority of the people in those states want to modify the ACA and not repeal it. And so essentially what's happened over the last year and a half is that the GOP went after the Affordable Care Act and they went after Medicaid, and to a lesser extent they went after Medicare. And in so doing, it's helped, because of the great organizing of groups all over the country, it's helped raise public opinion in support of those programs. People appreciate what they do. They appreciate why they're important. And those programs have become more important. And so it's a liability at this point, and it's certainly not an advantage for Republicans to be for repeal. I mean, after all, one of the things we learned in the Pennsylvania congressional race that was so highly contested last night was that the Republicans went off the air on their tax plan because about a week and a half ago they realized it wasn't popular enough to be an advantage, because it's also unpopular.
Yes, exactly. I'm the president put out, as you mentioned earlier, his own budget proposals. However, Congress is doing this other process that somewhat, at least in the short term, ignores what the president wants to say or do. But that said, what's the long-term strategy here? Longer-term strategy for the president and the Republicans in Congress.
I mean, I think that what's important about the president's budget is that it puts down a marker. It lays down priorities that he thinks are important, and it's an indication of what's to come from the Republicans in their budget. And it's why 2018 is so important, is because everything's up for grabs. And so in the president's budget, for example, he's proposed $1.6 billion in cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security disability, $213 billion in cuts to food assistance, cuts to education, cuts to housing assistance. And so what's important about the budget is it's a reflection of the direction that the Republicans want to go, and it's what they would do if they had even more power in the Senate and could move a budget forward. If they decided to use reconciliation, they could do the so-called the reconciliation process where you don't need 60 votes. They could do a bad budget, just like they did taxes. Thankfully, they have not decided to do that yet.
Great. And lastly, sort of looking ahead to the coming fall, you mentioned the election. How are the Democrats and the Republicans framing all of this stuff around health care? And how's it playing so far? You mentioned the special election in Pennsylvania.
I mean, I think that the way that it's been playing so far is since the Virginia and New Jersey elections in November, the gubernatorial elections, and in all of the special elections since then, healthcare has been playing incredibly well for Democrats. It's a very popular issue, and it's very simple. The Republicans have declared war on people's healthcare, and they want to take away your healthcare. And that message is incredibly powerful, and it has the advantage of being perfectly true. That's what the Republicans want to do. They want to take away our Medicare. They want to take away our Medicaid. They want to take away the ACA. And if they can't repeal the ACA, then they want to sabotage the law and take it apart piece by piece. That's what the president's trying to do, is dismantle the ACA since they can't repeal it. But in 2018, I think we go into the election strong because the public's on our side. And I think the 2018 elections are going to be a referendum on a lot of things. But one of those things is going to be health care, and the Democrats are going to win.
And how are the Republicans responding to this charge from the Democrats?
Frankly, the Republicans have been running from it. The majority leader of the Senate has said, we're not going to take up
repeal. They haven't been pushing on it heavily. Now, it is in their budgets, and so what they've been trying to do is talk about how they want to have welfare reform. That's been their new strategy. Their new strategy has been to talk about welfare reform and to include reform of Medicaid within that context, because they think that's a more popular way of going after Medicaid. But I think people see through that, and they know that that's just code for we want to take away your health care.
Great. Well, we've been doing a bit of catch-up on what's going on in Washington around healthcare issues. We've been speaking with Ethan Rome, who's co-executive director of Healthcare for America Now. Thanks so much for joining us back here on Health Action, Ethan.
Thanks very much.
Have a good day.
You too.
We'll be back with our third interview with Reverend Peter Cook with the New York State Council of Churches. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Health Action. I'm Mark Hannay. In our final interview segment today, we're going to be talking about how faith communities across New York are coming together and beginning to engage their parishioners and congregants around issues of social justice related to healthcare and social service programs. Joining us is Reverend Peter Cook, who is the executive director of the New York State Council of Churches. Welcome to Health Action, Reverend Cook.
Thank you. I'm really pleased to be here.
So before we get into what you're actually doing, and we do want to talk about an event coming up next week here in New York City and the Long Island area, maybe help frame generally overall sort of what's been happening in, since maybe the advent of the new political environment we find ourselves in nationally. How are people of faith responding to that?
So I think I'm seeing in our congregations so many people who are quite afraid that services on which they rely to survive and to be financially stable are being put in peril. And the first indicator of that was a strong attempt to try to repeal the Affordable Care Act, which, as all of us know, garnered a lot of opposition, and we were successful, people of faith and many others, to try to stop that from being implemented. And now we've moved to the tax cut bill, which is now a law, which, of course, had some appeal for some people because it put a little bit more money in their pockets. But it means that the federal and the state budgets get starved of needed revenue to pay for services of being health care.
Mm-hmm.
And so very scary to people. And I think that we are really trying to come back and say this is unnecessary and that there is a remedy to not be making these kinds of cuts on which so many of us depend.
Now, this new political era, as it's been termed, has been highly polarizing politically. However, we know that religious congregations have members that cross the entire political spectrum. How do faith leaders such as yourself manage that?
Well, it's difficult. It's always been difficult for churches. We've always had what we call politically diverse congregations. But I think we've been doing seminars around the state to help faith leaders work with politically diverse communities. And one place that we like to start is to have people really get in touch with what's going on with them and the people who are sitting around them. So we'll often ask how many of you have to spend more than 30% of your income on housing, how many of you can't afford your health care costs, how many of you are struggling to find child care, those kinds of questions. And if people sit down and honestly answer that question, they will discover that no matter how they voted, whether they voted for Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton or a Democrat or, you know, or a Republican, that those kinds of needs do not relate to one's political preference. So if you can really bring it down into the concrete, and then we talk together about, well, how is it that we can work together to prevent these kinds of cuts from happening. That's not going to sell everybody, but I think that it helps to open up the conversation. And we do it without trying to, you know, attack the president or the Democratic leader or, you know, whoever that is, but really look at what are the policies that are in place and how do we go about changing it.
One of the new initiatives to emerge on the scene in the last year coming out of the faith community has been the Poor People's Campaign. It's evoking back to Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's initiatives around that some 50 years ago. How is that developing here in New York?
So our colleagues at the Labor Religion Coalition are the lead organizer for New York for the Poor People's Campaign, which has now found its way into 37 states across the country. And what that campaign is really seeking to do is to give voice to people who are poor and disenfranchised to say that there really are changes that can be made in public policy that can aid and assist the most vulnerable among us. And it's really trying to change the narrative that we have spinning out there, that it's your fault if you're poor or that you have some kind of a moral deficit because you can't pay your bills. What we like to say is that, you know, poverty is the issue, not the individual's character who happened to be in poverty. So it attempts to address what Martin Luther King called the three sins, which is militarism, poverty and racism, and then a fourth one, which is environmental degradation. So we have people of faith and people of no faith all over the state of New York who will be engaged in 40 days of civil disobedience beginning on Mother's Day to really amplify the needs of people in our community who have been marginalized because of very destructive economic and political policies.
Great. And lastly, your organization is kicking off a bus tour across the state next week, and one of your stops will be here in New York City. Let's just lay out the tour itself, and then we can zero in what's happening here locally.
Absolutely. So this is a bus tour to really call on the rich to be paying more, and we have several proposals about how they could do that so that we don't have to have an austerity budget at the state or the federal level. So that's the basic message. And we begin in Long Island on Monday, the 20th, at 9:45 at Our Lady of the Miraculous Medal in Wyandanch on Long Island. And then we head over to the Bronx to St. Luke's Episcopal Church, which has a lunch program and many other services that they provide in the afternoon around 12:30. And then we go to Kingston after that, to the Old Dutch Reform Church to meet with a variety of social service agencies. We have two stops in Albany, one at the Capitol, the Million Dollar Staircase at 1, and then RISE, which is a refugee center, which will be at 3 o'clock And then the next day, we will be in Utica at a women and children's home before arriving in Buffalo for our final event, which is Back to Basics Ministries, which helps people who are reentering society after being incarcerated.
So in the last minutes, let's zero in on the Bronx. Remind us again when and where and how people can participate.
Yeah, so St. Luke's Episcopal Church, which is on 222nd Street, and we will be showing up there around 12 o'clock, and we anticipate having a press conference at around 1:30. And we would love to have people come and stand with us and really have a show of force to say that together that we think that an austerity budget is a fiction and that there are enough resources in God's economy to provide for the services that we need.
Yes, and this will be next Monday, March 19th.
That's correct.
Yes, right. So 12 to 1:30, 2 o'clock-ish at St. Luke's Church in the Bronx. And people can get information on your website for the New York State Council of Churches.
Yes, and also on our Facebook page. We have an event page that's there.
Great. Well, thank you. We've been speaking with Reverend Peter Cook, who's Executive Director of the New York State Council of Churches, about how faith communities are coming together and mobilizing in response to austerity politics. Thanks so much for joining us here on Health Action, Reverend Cook.
You're welcome, and thank you for this opportunity.
You're welcome. And that'll do it for our show this week. We'll be back with another program next week. Thanks for joining us here on Health Action. I'm Mark Hannay. Thanks to Catherine Davis for engineering the program.
And you're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM. And that program was not only brought to you on recording, but it ran 7 minutes short. So in theory, I ought to have, well, 7 minutes more of stuff to go. I'm not even sure what was on the computer on which it was playing. Oh, great. They've got it locked with a password. There. Okay, and that's where it was. That was playing, I imagine. Okay, so let's find... let's find some carts to put up. There seem to be some over here. And these are all IDs. These are all just nah. Let's see. Do I have some music with me that I can play? I'm sure I have for the... we got 5.5 minutes to go. Let's find 5.5 minutes of music, shall we? Just give me a moment here. Because I wasn't expecting to just walk in and all of a sudden there would be silence in the room. That's not how it's supposed to, you know, God forbid WBAI would offer you any silence, right? Yeah, I didn't think you'd see that. Okay, one more try. Here we are. Here's a place that has some interesting tunes. Okay. And there was that was the 5 minute mark. Did you hear that? Well, let's just say it's not the end of the world as we know it.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes and airplanes.
Or maybe it is the end of the world that we know it. This is REM.
I have a hurricane, listen to yourself, churn world, serves its own needs, dummy, serve your own needs, beat it up, an ox, speak, grunt, no strength, the ladder starts to clatter with fear, fight down, high, wire in a fire, representatives have engaged in a government for hire and a combat site, left to us are coming in a hurry with the furies beating down your neck, team my team, reporters battle Trump, tether crop, look at that, no plane, find them, overflow, population, common food, but it'll do, save yourself, serve yourself, world, serves its own needs, listen to your heart. Slice and burn, return, listen to yourself churn. Lock it in, uniform and book, burning blood, letting every motive escalate, automotive centering. Light a candle, light a motor, step down, watching heel crush, crush, uh-oh, this means no fear. Cavalier, renegade, steer clear, a tournament of lies. Offer me solutions, offer me alternatives, and I decline. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. Lester Banks, birthday party, cheesecake, jelly bean, boom, you symbiotic, patriotic, slam, but neck, right?
It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end. of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. And I feel fine.
At this time, the National Space Administration requires all aliens to register. Forms are available at your local post office. Those without forms must appear, however briefly, at the Bureau's astral offices on Nooker Street. Aliens, register now.
WBAI, New York. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to fantasy, science fiction, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, a review, a short story, and a remembrance of two people. Stay tuned. Oh, and no Facebook Live. I left my tripod at home. We'll be right back.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. There is a moment in Justice League, which is now out on home video and on demand, when a Russian family living in the shadow of a shuttered nuclear reactor, more on that later, has their home besieged by a swarm of Mothmen. During this, there's a shot where a young girl reaches up and pulls down a can of bug spray from a shelf. And it was a full 30 seconds before I realized, oh, that's a joke. Now, I don't particularly consider myself the most acute of intellects, but I think I'm pretty good at picking out humorous moments when they present themselves. So the fact that I was debating whether or not I should have been laughing at that moment can only mean that director Zack Snyder is once again working at the top of his form, taking something that should be fun and exciting and sapping all the life out of it until what's left is a mass of computer-generated bombast glazed with shades of inky black. It's always been clear that DC has been trying to model their most recent films in the format of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, with everything leading up to Justice League being DC's Avengers. Turns out the replication is so blatant that it's kind of embarrassing. Joss Whedon contributed to the script, and his facility with wit and character show up here and there, but not enough. The villain, Steppenwolf, voiced by Charon Hines, and computer-generated on the screen, sports Loki-like horns, seeks a trio of magical widgets that will permit him world conquest like Loki, and is accompanied by that swarming phalanx of Mothmen, who are not unlike the Chitauri. Of course, the finale has to see the Justice League teaming up to kick Mothman Tookus, although since the throwdown is set in that abandoned nuclear facility rather than a teeming Manhattan, the battle loses a certain resonance. That one besieged family has to substitute, along with the admittedly amusing sight of Superman airlifting an entire apartment building out of harm's way. The irony is that while the Avengers movies function as culmination, all the individual Marvel movies preceding them leading up to the explosive action of an Avengers team-up, Justice League struggles to level the DC universe up to some kind of franchise baseline, a kind of reassurance that things are getting back to normal. Superman, played by Henry Cavill, and whose digitally airbrushed upper lip didn't bother me quite as much as it did everybody else, doesn't kill anybody. Batman, as portrayed by Ben Affleck, has a bit more spring in his step than he did in Batman v Superman, and is teamed up, the brave and the bold style, with a youthful, novice Flash, played by Ezra Miller, who is unabashedly styled as Peter Parker to Bruce Wayne's Tony Stark. And I kind of liked Jason Momoa's burly, confident spin to Aquaman, very Chris Hemsworth-like. Okay, I gotta stop this. Let me just note that Gal Gadot is Wonder Woman again, and I don't think she's used quite as well as she could be. I'm looking forward to her getting back to her own films. And Ray Fisher is Cyborg, and that's it. He's Cyborg. He's fine. Thing is, for all that Snyder seems to be conceding that the DC universe is better served when it isn't awash in objectivism, he's still Zack Snyder. And for all the action and spectacle and quips, a certain stolidness accompanies his efforts. On paper, Justice League promises a serviceable superhero exercise. Not more than that, but that could have been enough. In execution, though, the film still disappoints. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons, hashtag ITMFA.
And thank you, Dan. Okay, well, first of all, I brought my phone, I brought, you know, which has its camera in it, and I brought various things so that I would be able to do a Facebook Live, which I haven't been able to do in a little while. Actually, I did one this weekend at a science fiction convention, Heliosphere, which you'll be hearing, by the way, next week. I did two interviews with guests of honor, and that's what's going to be on our show next week. Will be Charles E. Gannon and Eric Flint, each of them fascinating and wonderful people who also collaborate in fiction. But who also have very much major careers on their own. At any rate, so I've been doing Facebook Live very happily and very with a great deal of enthusiasm pretty much since the beginning of this year. And if you want to see any of them, you can go to my timeline on Facebook, Jim Freund, F-R-E-U-N-D, and you can watch some of the shows as I do them. But as I mentioned a few weeks ago that I was going to do a show and not do Facebook Live, a regular listener wrote me on Facebook and said, good, that you're not doing it because too much Facebook Live, I wasn't necessarily focusing on the radio aspect of the show. And I thought about that, and there's some truth. Now, the thing about doing the Facebook Live is that not only does it let you see me doing the show, but more importantly, you get to chat to me and to each other, and I can take a look at it and say, oh, well, such and such is asking this question, and I'll respond. And also people will chat with each other. But various things began to happen, and this is why I believe this listener made that comment, which I think has a good point, and it's that it was another distraction. Now, the very cool thing is not only do people get to type in and comment, but when I get home, I can look at all the comments, those that I didn't have time to during the show itself, and I can respond then, and people respond back. And there's maybe, oh, up to 10 people watching the show live at once. It's, after all, 1:10 in the morning in New York, and later on, you know, before the show is over, it's 2:45. Not that many people in New York following the Facebook Live, although it's nice to know that I have a couple of people from abroad, one fellow from Wales, another one from Bangkok and so forth. He's going to be here in April. It's Somtao Sucharitkul. And the conversation can go on for weeks. And so to me, this is like a new medium. I was pretty much active in the earliest days of online activity with BBSs and stuff like that. I was online as early as, say, late 1980 and then onward. The internet was not a major thing at that point. And there were various online services, but I'm not going to go into all of that history. But it's relevant to the point that Facebook is now the face of the home for so many people. If Google is the one supplying all the services and sucking all the information out of you as you do it so that they can monetize that information, Facebook is the place that's doing the same thing and trying to provide your home. And, well, I have strong feelings about the differences between various services and what's good and what's evil. And if we do get into that, it'll be later on in the show, not so much now. But the idea that I could be actually having that conversation several weeks after the show, and people could be discovering the show anew. They could watch it. You can watch my show from 3 months ago right now. Well, after this is over. And then, when that is all done, you can type in a comment and other viewers or I will type back. And so it goes on. So that's really a new medium. That's really a new way of looking at